I wanted to take up something that we passed by last week, and that was Psalms 19. David mentioned Psalms 19. Now, I just want to make sure that you understand what the meaning of Psalm 19 is. Proverbs 19, excuse me. Proverbs 19. Now, Proverbs 19, it says that better is the poor that walketh in his integrity than he that is perverse in his lips and a fool at the same time. Now, I don't want you to think that this means that the poor that walketh in his integrity does not mean a person who is ignorant and who is, but who is honest. That's not what it means. Because, you see, the second half of the proverb states, that better is the poor that walketh in his integrity than he that is perverse in his lips and a fool at the same time. So, he is, he's reprimanding the person that is perverse in his lips because he's a fool. And in 2, he continues and he says, also that the soul be without knowledge is not good. So he's not trying to say that there's any perfection in being without knowledge. And the meaning of the first part is, what he's referring to is, what he's saying is, it's better for a person to be poor, meaning to say, if a person is not a shrewd businessman, he is better off if he's an honest person than an individual who lies and who is a fool. In other words, he's overpowered by the desire to the desire of the moment to lie in order to and cheat in order to make a dollar. Now, what King Solomon is saying is that person, even though he earns money, he is worse off than the poor individual, because since he is a fool and he's functioning simply by the emotion of the moment and the desire to make a pretense in order to earn money, in order to fool people, eventually it will catch up with him, and he will have more headaches and more pain out of his success than the poor man who remains poor and just may not have the luxuries of life, but at least he has that peace of mind. And this person is going to be worse off. That's what he's saying. But he's not saying that the poor man is virtuous. He's just saying that the poor man is better off than the wise guy. In other words, the person who was overpowered by the emotion of the moment to fabricate in order to cheat and fool people. But he's a fool. You see, that's why he says, and a fool at the same time. He means to say the person is just overpowered by the emotion of the moment. He's not really a thought-out, planned-out type of person. So since that's the case, since he's overpowered by the emotion of the moment, he's going to suffer. Now, he says like this. He says, when he continues, he says, also that the soul be without knowledge is not good. So he says, even though the poor man may be better off, but it's not really the best state, because this poor man we were referring to before, even though he may have his integrity, but he doesn't really have knowledge, and therefore it is not good. He is not in really a good state, because he does not have the knowledge, which really is what the soul needs. And that's why he continues and he says, and he that hasteth with his feet sinneth. That means to say, what he's saying over here is, first, he posits that in order for a person to partake of the good, he must have knowledge, and therefore, while the person who is ignorant and has integrity is better off than the person who fabricates and who lies and cheats and is a fool, that may be so. But this first person is not really in any way perfected because he doesn't have knowledge, and that's why he says, that the soul be without knowledge is not good. But he continues, and he says, and he that hasteth with his feet sinneth. What he means by a person that hasteth with his feet means a person that's impulsive. What he's trying to add over here is simply that You have to have knowledge. That's one thing. The soul must have knowledge. If the soul does not is not surrounded with an environment of knowledge, the soul can never really be in its natural state and can never be happy. But he says, nevertheless, even though a person may have knowledge, you have to translate that knowledge into action. So a person that hasteth with his feet means a person that's impulsive. An impulsive individual will always sin. Why? Because an impulsive individual reacts on the spur of the moment to a certain situation, to certain stimuli. And since they react impulsively, even though they may have knowledge, they can't translate that knowledge into action. And therefore, what he's saying is that you need the knowledge. The soul must have knowledge, first of all, in order to enjoy life. The soul must have knowledge and ideas. That's number one. And two, the soul must translate that knowledge into action when the situation occurs, when it's necessary to do that. And in order to do that, there must be a time. You must have a time gap there. In other words, before a person reacts to a situation, he has to go through a thinking process, and he can't hasten. He can't go quickly. If he's impulsive, then the knowledge is worthless, and he's going to sin. He's going to fail. Okay, I just wanted to clarify those two verses because I got the impression last week that some people may think that King Solomon was praising the poor fool. You see. And that's not what he's doing. He's saying he's not praising the person that's poor. As a matter of fact, in the Talmud, and even in the Torah itself and Tanakh itself, a poor is never associated with virtue. Being poor is not a virtue, not in Torah, not in Tanakh. The rabbis tell us that every prophet was extremely wealthy. And that's one of the requirements of a prophet, is to be wealthy. Talmud says, for instance, by Jonah, when he went and he paid the he went on the ship and he paid the wages. So Talmud says that there was no one. He paid for the entire ship. He said, "We're going, we're moving, no passengers today," and he paid for the entire ship. That's why there's nobody else on the ship, if you notice in the dialogue, besides Jonah and the captain and the sailors, because he pays for the entire voyage. So Talmud says that every prophet was every one of the prophets was wealthy, a wealthy person. We do not equate rush. As a matter of fact, poverty is always equated with failure. It doesn't necessarily mean that a person that's poor is a failure, don't get me wrong. But poverty is equated with failure because it indicates all things being equal, it indicates that the person is not going about his business.
Rabbi,
yes.
Define poverty.
Define poverty? Poverty means when a person is not capable of earning the amount that he needs to satisfy his requirements, his needs. That's how I would define it. But
okay, let me say this: they are in poverty because obviously she doesn't have what she needs or wants,
right,
or something.
Needs.
Yeah, but see, the needs, but if a person has, and I'm not just putting it to the lowest common denominator, but I am also, but if a person provides food, shelter, and clothing,
right,
for himself and his family,
right,
is that considered poverty?
No. See, what I wanted to say was that I'll give you an example. The Talmud says that the Talmud speaks about wine, drinking wine. And the Talmud says the word wine in Hebrew is T-Rush. And the Talmud just makes a play on that word. And it says the word, the last part of the word, Rush, could either mean a head or it could mean poor. So the Talmud says it depends on how the person drinks. If a person drinks appropriately, in other words, he doesn't overindulge, he just drinks moderately, then it's good for his head. It's good for him. It relaxes him. It's good for his mind. And he will even be a greater scholar. And on the other hand, if he overindulges, he doesn't know the proper amount, then it will make him rush, which means poor. Same word that you have over here. It will make him poor. Now, why does the Talmud say it will make him poor? What it means is it will make him fail. And poverty is an example of financial failure. Even though it does say in Ecclesiastes that I've also seen that not to the wise, not unto the wise is bread, and what was Elohim lechem velo anavonim osher, and not to the understanding wealth. So he says that he does say that it's true that it's not always the case that a person that is wise will even if he puts his mind to it will be successful, because there's always a factor, there's always an element of chance involved. But on the whole, all things being equal, poverty is on the whole is a sign of failure. That's why the Talmud uses that statement that if a person drinks too much, he'll become poor. And many times you find in the Talmud where
Rama,
good.
All right, I'm bringing you back to that because it's come up here again in when you're saying this, because this is an important thing to me and some of these people here. Not the poverty aspect, that's important, but what about if the government, one of the men made the statement, if a person is living, quote, off the government, and he's not providing the basic essentials for his or her family,
right,
and the government is doing it, is that considered poverty? Because, see, we're leading up to this thing.
Yes, that definitely. You know, the person is not earning a living, and the person is taking money from the government in order to survive.
Yeah, well, they're taking money from the government in order to survive,
right.
And they're not to sustain themselves. They cannot work to put the basic essentials together.
I understand. You see, I'm not speaking about specific individual cases. As I said, even King Solomon says that he's seen wise people that weren't able to earn a living. So there are exceptional cases. Also, you have people like, for instance, Hillel was a very poor man, but that's because that's all he wanted out of life. He chopped wood; he was a wood chopper, and he had enough. As soon as he had enough to take care of himself and his household, he didn't work anymore. He wasn't interested in money. But what the Talmud is doing is what I mentioned before is that all things being equal, an intelligent person who acts rationally will be more successful at earning money than a person who acts irrationally and unintelligently. In other words, that's why poverty sometimes is used as an example of failure, because it's a venture in which how a person goes about making a living is important. And as a matter of fact, the Maimonides speaks about this, where he says that the blessings in the Torah only come to those who act intelligently and wisely. And he quotes the verse from Samuel. It says that King David was wise in all his ways, and God was with him. He says because he acted intelligently and executed his obligations properly, God assisted him. But if a person acts foolishly, and if a person in the area of earning a livelihood, a person doesn't prepare themselves for life, and then they go about making foolish ventures and investing their money in an unintelligent way, they lose it. That area is given over to man to act intelligently, and if a person doesn't, it's a failure on his part. Of course, it does not mean that every person that doesn't have financial wealth is a failure. As I said before, a person might not be interested in accumulating wealth. All it means is that all things being equal, the person that goes about his financial responsibilities in an intelligent way will be more successful than a person who doesn't. And people who are wealthy, provided they aren't guilty of acting in a criminal way, acting illegally, then on the whole it indicates that these people did acted intelligently with regard to monetary matters. So that's the way the Torah looks at it. It does not point a finger at a person who is poor. As a matter of fact, you know, the Torah says that there are two conflicting verses in Deuteronomy. One says that there will never cease to be a poor man among the nation of Israel. And the other verse says there will not be a poor man among you. So the rabbis say that they point out the contradiction. And they say it depends. It depends on whether the people of Israel are living according to the Torah, then there won't be any poor people. And if they don't live properly according to the Torah, then there will be poor people. And I try to explain this, to demystify this, and to just explain it. And it means that if you have a society that's living according to Torah, it means it's a society that's living according to knowledge. And if the society is living according to knowledge, it will act intelligently in all their undertakings. And therefore, the people will be intelligent, and they will raise the children, their children, properly. And there's no need, really, if a society is intelligent, to have a poverty situation. By poverty, I mean a person that's intrinsically incapable of making a living, not to a physical or mental handicap, but to a personality defect. And that's what we have today. If a person is unable to earn a living, then certainly that's a different situation. But here, what the Torah is saying is that if the society lives properly, then the people in the society will all be intelligent, and there won't be any poor people. However, when the society doesn't live properly, then they're not acting intelligently, then you have individuals who are misfits and who are incapable of earning a living because of psychological misorientation. And I've seen many poor people. Many poor people come into the yeshiva. And of course, we help them, and we try to support them as much as we can. But aside from people being displaced, like Russians coming to America or some other situation, every one of those poor people, if you look into their lives, you will see there is a problem there. There is an emotional problem. There's a reason why they cannot earn a living. It's not a mystery. It's not simply that God just said this man's supposed to be poor. It's because the person is not properly oriented, and they're not functioning intelligently in that area. So that's why I say that in general, in the general Torah view, poverty not only isn't looked upon as a virtue, but poverty is looked upon as a failure because it results from the inability of a person to act rationally with regard to his money. That's what I wanted to point out. I didn't, heaven forbid, mean to say that a person that is doesn't have X amount of dollars or is poor is in any way evil or anything like that. I mean, there are various situations. Just in a general way, Okay, did I make the point clear?
I think so, but I would say back to the question that Gary put forth, that if a person is incapable, and we will not talk about a specific case, but let's just, and I will make a hypothetical situation, that A lives off of government subsidies, that the entire life is underwritten by the government, which therefore means that taxpayers, those people that are working, are paying for that person's livelihood.
That's right.
Then that person cannot remain in that position if they acquire a knowledge of Torah. Is that putting it?
That's correct. As a matter of fact, Maimonides states that a person who says, I will study Torah and I'll take money from charity. After all, they had systems in those days also where society, the city, would support the people who didn't have money. So if you don't have any money, you simply go to the town, to the people that were in charge, and they would dispense money to the poor, to the needy. So Maimonides says anyone that says that I will study Torah. I'll spend the whole day studying Torah, and I won't work. And the way I'll earn a living is from charity. So this is a person like that loses his entire, he loses entirely his place in the world to come, and he is degrading Torah, and he's going off the path of Torah, and is doing the worst possible thing. And obviously, God wants man to, as a matter of fact, the greatest scholars of the Talmud would not take anything from anybody. Even people that offer them presents, they refuse. Because the highest level is for man to earn his own living and not to take anything from charity. If a person must of necessity, then in order to avoid any kind of catastrophe, fine. Then they should do it, and they have to do it. But if a person doesn't, if a person just feels that they will simply be a parasite of society, that is completely unethical, and it's against the whole philosophy of Torah. Okay.
All right, we got another question on this line that, and you're bringing in the charity aspect. It's a great mitzvah to do charity. Mm-hmm. All right, but do you do charity to an individual that does not help themselves?
Well, you see, that's the thing. The thing is that the when it comes to charity, if a person does not help themselves, but honestly, they cannot afford to live. Now, the way they used to give charity wasn't so simple. They didn't just give charity to anybody. They had to be below a poverty level, which means they had practically $0, just enough for a few meals. And you're not permitted to let a person go hungry or let a person go without clothes or without the basic necessities. No matter why the person does it, we must support that person, because you cannot go into the mind of an individual and say, well, this person isn't helping themselves, so I'm not going to help them, let them starve, or let them go without clothes, or let them be cold. You can't do that, because you don't know whether a given individual has control over their emotions or not. And it's difficult for us. We really can't evaluate another human being. I mean, the only one that evaluates another human being is God. So if a person lets himself reach that level, there is something wrong with them, certainly at least psychologically. And you have to help them because of that. I mean, some of the poor people that come to the yeshiva, I mean, there's one fellow that comes to yeshiva, and basically he's jovial. I mean, he considers it like a racket almost, you know. I mean, he comes and he makes his money, he goes here and there, and but somebody might say, well, why support him? But the point is, anyone that, you know, if the person even a person that does that, there's something wrong with the individual, something wrong with the person. And every human being we're required to show compassion to and not allow them to starve to death or to go without clothes. We don't have to make them wealthy. You know, we don't have to give them anything beyond the basic necessities. That's the way the halacha works. Except in a certain case where an individual was used to, if a person was used to a high lifestyle and they suddenly lost their money and they reached the poverty level, then you have to support them in accordance with the style they were used to, because that psychological factor is considered extremely important also. But in general, we just, you know, give the poor man his what he needs in meager necessities.
Peggy McKinn liked that answer, because now she don't have to worry about Charlie going broke, because she's still going to get her bonbons.
That's correct.
He said that is correct. As long as she can shop till she drops and you know, maintain that lifestyle, she's a happy camper.
That's right. I mean, it sounds strange, but the coin to halacha, a person like myself would be obligated to support if an individual was extremely wealthy and they had a chauffeured limousine, then I'd have to give charity in order this person could drive around a chauffeured limousine, even though I don't have it myself. But for him, it's a necessity. But we don't offer that to the poor. we only say those who have had it and suddenly went broke, then you have to try to maintain their lifestyle because of psychological needs.
Okay, I think we pretty well got that one.
Okay.
That, wait a minute, we got a question. Jeff. All right, he said, well, he was thinking along the same lines. I know we got another one on this. What about, you know, he was saying the preachers today that really dupe people into giving them their money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that shows you, again, the psychological problem that people have. They think that they send Oral Roberts $1,000, that guy's going to give him $10,000 back.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to steal your thunder, but you go ahead. That's what the question is.
The thing is that the actually the scholars of Israel never, as I said before, never took any money from anybody, and they were the greatest teachers in the world, and they didn't take anything. Each one had a profession. Each one had a profession. One was a blacksmith, one was a woodchopper. Some were wealthy. Some of them were very wealthy. There was one that owned literally inherited cities, and he was extremely wealthy. But Rabbi Judah the Prince was a very wealthy man. Some were wealthy, some were poor. But none of them ever went to the public for funds. And the Torah really, I mean, in a way, today we're not really living the 100% the way the system should be. Because the Torah maintains that an individual who has to turn to another for funds, for money, for his sustenance, first of all, it takes away his direct relationship with God. Because it makes him feel dependent on another human being, which is bad, because it's a breach in the relationship between man and God. And secondly, the person can never really be a free agent, because he's being controlled by people who have the bucks. And that's why in the system of the Torah, the leader and the teacher never took any money. You're not permitted to take money for teaching Torah. And each one supported themselves with their own profession, and each one had a profession. Today, we don't do it that way, even among the religious people. So they give answers. They say, well, we can't do it that way, and if we don't take money, then the yeshivas are going to go down, and we won't have any Torah at all, and it's the lesser of two evils, etc., etc. But, you can give answers from today till tomorrow, but the fact remains that we are not really fulfilling the system according to the way it was meant to be, and we won't be until a rabbi and a teacher is independent. Once you lose your independence, it's a very bad thing. I mean, you can't help it. If you have a person in your congregation that he's the major financial pillar of the community, you're going to have a hard time going against some of his ideas, no matter how crazy they are. And you lose your sense of your ability to be honest and judicious. And you know what Torah says. The Torah says that you shouldn't take any a person now will take a bribe. And the Talmud is a whole lengthy discussion in the Talmud on that, and it says clearly it doesn't mean to say to take a bribe to distort justice. That the Torah doesn't have to tell you that, because you're not allowed to distort justice. It means even if you, as a judge, are convinced that you're going to give the correct verdict, and you're not going to be swayed by this man's generosity. You're not permitted to do that. You're not permitted to take any money from any of the litigants. And it's a major violation of the Torah, because the moment you take money from that person, you could be the most righteous individual, but you are going to be swayed by that money, and you cannot help yourself. It's impossible to control. And the Torah says that the bribery, graft, is distorts the words of the wise and the righteous. So the Torah is calling the person righteous. It means that they are truly righteous. And yet the Torah says the most righteous individual and the wisest person will cease to see clearly the moment someone benefits him. So, as a matter of fact, you're not even allowed to take from both litigants an equal amount. It's interesting. But the taking of money is a subordination on the part of the judge. He's being subordinated. And the same thing with a teacher, and the same thing with a leader. So the leaders in Israel, the prophets, as I said, were every one of them, the Talmud says, was wealthy, including Moses. And that was important because they had to be independent, and they had to look for their sustenance only from God, not from any human being.
Well, we've got to change the tape.
Okay.
Is this, there are a lot of religious groups that pump a lot of money into Israel as charity. Now, are they permitted to, according to Halakha, are they permitted to accept these the money from these Christian or other organizations that do not that are not working, living according to Torah?
That's a good question. You're allowed to, you're permitted to accept the money. You are permitted to accept the money. There's no technical violation. But the question, of course, is, like, as a matter of fact, the Rabbi Soloveitchik was, years ago, he discussed the question of reparations, to take reparations from Germany. This was in the 60s. This was a big issue. So the question was, are you allowed to technically? Yes, you are allowed to. But he said, ethically, he says, you have to ask the 6 million people who were destroyed by the Germans what they would say about that. And he felt that it wasn't such a simple matter to take money from corrupt people. You see, and this I mentioned a number of times, the halacha takes care of numerous, thousands and thousands, almost infinite possibilities, because as time changes, you see that new possibilities arise, and halacha still can answer. But halacha still has a boundary, and there are certain things that the halacha does not prohibit. Nevertheless, it's a question of justice, whether it's just to take money from such people. But technically, according to halacha, there is no violation.
Okay. I guess, wait a minute, got another one.
Oh, there's one thing I wanted to add.
Okay, go ahead.
There's one thing I wanted to add, that the only money that a teacher would take, and this is something which is correct, the money a teacher would take it was money for instance, if a teacher had a job, and someone said, look, I want you to teach me, and the rabbi would say, well, look, I have to earn a living. So he'd say, look, how much are you earning? I'll give you the money that you would have earned those hours, and you study with me. That's permissible. That is permissible. So most people today feel that it's not a violation to take the money for teaching, because they're only taking money which they, the amount that they could have earned. But of course, that places a certain kind of a limit, a realistic limit on it. It doesn't mean that they don't have to be poverty stricken, but it means to say it has to be within reason. But those people, like you mentioned, the evangelists, where that is criminal. I mean, they're just ripping off the public. I mean, it's criminal. Aside from the fact that their cause is idolatrous, but I mean, just the idea that it's just such a concept is criminal in Torah. You're not permitted to. The most a person can take is what he actually would have earned had he been involved in his profession. But beyond that, he's not permitted to take anything. There was a situation where somebody in my yeshiva was offered an enormous sum to teach somebody, and I said to that person, I said, it's questionable whether you're allowed to. It's not only questionable; it's basically prohibited, because you're not allowed to take money for teaching Torah more than the actual amount that you would have earned during that time. And this person was being offered three or four times the amount by a very wealthy individual. And that's against the halacha.
Okay, I think we got it, and so we're ready to learn Torah now.
Okay.
All right.
What I'd like to take up tonight is in the first blessing of the Shimon Esrei. So the conclusion is, a king who assists and who offers salvation and who is a shield. Do you people have that? Do you people know what I'm referring to? It's in the we're in the Shimon Esrei, and we're going through the blessing word for word. The last the last part of that the text of that blessing. Okay, it says a king referring to God, and I don't have the translation in front of me, so I'm just giving it to you myself. A king who owes there, who assists, and who offers salvation, and who is a shield. And then we say, "Blessed art thou, O God, the shield of Abraham." Okay? Do you have that?
Okay, here it is. It says, "O King, Helper, Savior, Shield, blessed are you, Hashem, Shield of Abraham."
That's right. That's correct.
That is correct.
Okay.
Okay, we got
now,
it.
Now, what I'd like to discuss, in these few words, is that there is a somewhat of a problem here, because it says that God is a helper, and he is a salvation, a savior as well. Now, and a shield. Okay. A savior means when a person is facing destruction, he needs a savior. And God, indeed, saves people even though they may be in imminent danger. So the Talmud says that even if a sword, the blade of a sword is against one's throat, one should never give up and not pray to God, because God can always save the individual. And that was the dialogue, by the way, between Isaiah and Hezekiah, because Isaiah told Hezekiah that he's going to die, and Hezekiah said that he says no, it's not true. He says, "I know one thing. I have a Kabbalah. Kabbalah means a tradition, something which is accepted from the scholars, that even if there's a sword on a person's throat, one should not refrain from praying to God." So he prayed to God, and God answered him, as you know. So certainly God is a salvation. Now, a shield is something else. A shield means that he acts in a way that he doesn't allow the danger to come in contact with the person. And that's the second attribute of God. And those are ways that we don't even realize, and we don't even know in our lives, how we are shielded through God's protection. So we say these two things. And these two things are intelligible. We understand them. But the one where it says he's a helper, that one seems a bit difficult, because there seems to be redundancy here. If God doesn't only help one, but he actually saves an individual who is in great peril. So certainly, you don't have to say that he helps. If a person does a greater thing, you don't praise him for a smaller thing. And in the same manner, when we refer to God, if God does the greater thing, we praise him for the greater thing. And certainly, we understand that God helps man as well. What additional information is there in the appellation of God as a helper? What are we trying? What is what do the rabbis, the scholars who formulated the prayer, mean to add by that God is a helper? Now, if we take a look in the prayer immediately that precedes the Shemon Esrei, there is a statement again by these same people who formulated the prayer. It says that, by the way, it's the men of the Great Assembly. It says, "You are the helper of our forefathers from old," and it says, "And you are a shield and a salvation to their offspring, to their children." So this is broken up. It says that you were a helper to the forefathers, and a shield and a salvation to the to their children. Now, why that breakup? I'm just using that as a clue. Now, there's an interesting piece of Talmud in the Tractate of Kedushin that I think offers us a little insight into this concept over here. And it's in Kedushin 31b. And a very extremely interesting piece of Talmud that has to do with an understanding of Torah philosophy in general. I'm sorry, 30b. Okay, it says like this, that the rabbis stated that it says, "And you shall place these my words upon your heart." Now, my words refers to the words of the Torah, of course. So the Talmud dissects the word place. And it says the word place comes from two words, some and tum. So some means a medicine, a medication. And now the Talmud explains what is the meaning? Why is there an implication of medication here? And the Talmud says like this: the Torah is like an elixir of life. Now it gives a parable. It says a parable. It gives a parable of a father, who struck his son with a very hard blow, and he put a bandage on his wound, and he said to him, "My son, as long as this bandage is on your wound, you can eat whatever you wish and drink whatever you wish to drink, and do anything you want, and you don't have to have any fear. But if you take off this bandage, then the wound is going to fester." So the Talmud says, so too God says to the people of Israel, "My son, I created the evil inclination, and I created Torah as a medication. If you are involved in Torah, you will not be given over to the evil inclination. But if you fail to be involved in Torah, then you will be given over to him immediately." And the Talmud goes on, and it's speaking about the evil inclination. But let's just stop here for a moment and understand what this piece of Talmud is. It's an interesting thing. The Talmud over here is giving a very, very deep advice. The Talmud, when it gives this parable, it says that a person is just like the sick individual, the sick son who the father struck, and now he has a wound, and now he requires this salve and this ointment and this bandage. And he says, so too God says to the people of Israel when he gave the Torah. He says that I created the Torah, and I created the evil inclination. I created the Torah as a medication, as an antidote. Now, what it means is like this: that most people in life like to think of themselves as being healthy. There's a normal kind of a person. And everybody has an image in their mind of, I'm a normal person. I'm striving to be a normal person. I'm striving to be a good person. What the Talmud says is that in the Torah's eyes, there is no such thing. A person by nature is intrinsically ill, intrinsically sick. He's different than every other animal. Animals aren't sick. Animals have a certain profile, and they live according to their nature, and they're not in conflict, and they live properly. Man is a sickly being. He is intrinsically ill, and a person must always look at himself that way, the Talmud is saying. A person must look at himself as being intrinsically sick. What does this mean? It means to say that he can never attain happiness. He can never live properly unless he has a certain medication. What is that medication? That medication is Torah, being involved in Torah. It means to say that if a person would say, look, I'm going to live my life, and I'll be a good person, I'll do good things, and I'll keep God's laws and so far as I can, whether he's a Ben Noach or a Ben Israel, but I'm not going to pursue knowledge of Torah. I'm not going to do that. So the Talmud states that this person will sooner or later fall prey to the evil inclination. He will not be able to withstand it. And the only person that can be successful and virtuous is an individual who realizes that the sickness of man must have an antidote. Man by nature, his energies are never going in the proper direction. They're always going into the instinctual area. And the only way that he can correct that is by sublimating this energy, using this energy for a higher type of involvement. And that higher involvement is involvement in the pursuit of Torah knowledge. When a person's energies are directed towards that sphere, then he is capable of living a proper life. If he doesn't, then he has to fail. He must fall into the grips of the evil inclination. And one way or another, what comes to my mind is from the New Testament, where it's where Paul talks about his struggle with the his personal struggle with evil, and he mentions that the law didn't perfect him because what the law prohibited, he desired, and he was unable to refrain from violating the law. As a matter of fact, the law itself made it more attractive to him. And that's because Paul did not have any knowledge, any deep knowledge of Torah. Any person who simply tries to refrain from the abstain and to fight temptation on his own cannot be successful. That's what the Talmud is saying. That such a struggle, you're bound to fail. There's no way. There's no way out. Because the evil inclination is extremely powerful, and the instinctual drives are very forceful, and there's no way for a person to be able to constantly ward off temptation. He's going to get into this kind of a Christian kind of struggle with the temptation, trying to fight it off, and then he can't. And then he tries to fight, and he can't. And you'll wind up like a monk trying to constantly overpower his instinctual nature, his mind, his thoughts, and it'll be like those the Christians that went out into the desert and trying to flee from the evil inclination. All these kind of things are doomed to failure. There's only one method of success, and that is for a person to take the energy and to involve it in the pursuit of knowledge. And pursuit of knowledge, we mean the pursuit of Torah. If a person takes those energies and involves them in Torah and in knowledge, then he is able to remove those energies from the instinctual sources, and with that he's able to perfect himself and to be a truly virtuous person. Otherwise, he's doomed to failure. That's why the Talmud says the person must always view himself as a sick and unhealthy individual. Man by nature is unhealthy. That's why man by nature is unhappy, because man is always drawn by various instinctual forces. He's intrinsically a conflict. One side of him wants to do one thing, another side wants to do something else. If he's successful, then he's going to be unhappy because the other side is unhappy. And one way or another, he never attain happiness. And the evil inclination will has to destroy him. There's only one avenue of escape, and that is for a person to direct his energy towards God's thoughts, God's ideas, the ideas that he gives us in Torah. And that's the advice of the Talmud, how the Talmud understands the mitzvah of learning Torah and studying Torah. And of course, by learning Torah and studying Torah, we don't mean anything very mystical. We mean like we're doing right now. Everybody that's listening to the class is there because they're interested in ideas of Torah. And people who stay after and discuss ideas, that is the study of Torah. Study of Torah is the pursuit of knowledge and the pursuit of ideas. If you don't have that pursuit, then you are doomed. So the Talmud goes on to say that the evil inclination is so bad, the Talmud says, that even its creator called it evil. And it quotes the verse from Genesis, where it says the evil inclination of man is evil from his earliest moments. And that's another thing that the Torah maintains, that a child is not considered pure in the ideas of the Torah. On the contrary, a child is evil. The good aspect of man doesn't come about till, I'm sure you've heard the word bar mitzvah. That means the age of 13 for a male and 12 for a female. And that would apply, by the way, for Ben Noach as well, you know, because Ben Noach and Ben Israel are both the same in that respect. So actually, you could have a bar mitzvah where you appoint, you know, where the person becomes a responsible individual. And that is at that age. And now the Talmud explains that the you see from the verse in Genesis where it says that the evil inclination of man's evil inclination is man's inclination is evil. The inclination of the heart. Let me get the exact translation. The inclination of the heart of man is evil from its earliest moments. And the word ne'urav means nar, which also implies movement. And the Talmud states from the moment he moves, wiggles out of the womb of his mother, or her mother, which means to say that the instinctual life begins at birth. By the way, that's something which people think was a recent discovery of psychoanalysis. Instinctual life begins at birth. But it's a statement right in Genesis. You don't have to look too far. It's an open statement that the evil inclination of man, which is the instinctual life of man, begins from the moment of birth. As a matter of fact, the Talmud says that there was an argument between Rabbi Judah the prince and Antoninus, who was an emperor, Roman emperor, as to whether the instinctual even exists in the womb, in the embryonic form, in the fetus. And I don't remember the two positions. If you want, I'll have to look it up for you. But they were discussing that concept, whether the instinctual can exist prenatally. So, but definitely the Torah says that it exists from the moment of birth, that's for sure. And the good inclination doesn't arrive till the age of bar mitzvah or bas mitzvah, which is 12 for a male and 13 for a female. And the reason is because the good is where the rational is in control. And a child's rational is not in control. A child may be good, may be sweet, may be kind, but it's not because there is a rational element that is in control. A child doesn't have that ability. So if a child is good, of course he's naturally good. But naturally is not what the Torah considers good. Because even if a person is naturally kind, it's not a virtue unless that kindness is backed by reason. If the kindness is just natural, it can't be a virtue, because then you could be kind to a wicked person who will subsequently destroy a virtuous person, which wouldn't be the proper thing to do. So, or you'd be kind at a time when you're not supposed to be kind. So kindness is only a virtue if it's backed by reason. And that's why even though a child may be kind, we do not consider this to be the good. It's still a part of the instinctual. So at any rate, I got a little sidetracked. But the Talmud says that the inclination of the heart of man is evil from his earliest moments. So the Talmud says, you see, even God called the inclination evil. Now, what the Talmud means by even God, it means that God sees things differently than man. You know the story of Jonah, how God taught Jonah that his idea of compassion, he didn't have any compassion for Assyria. And God told Jonah, no, you're a human being, that's human compassion, but I am the Creator. And the Creator has a different view of his creatures. My compassion is different than yours. And he had compassion for Assyria, even though it was a wicked nation, but they repented and God accepted them. So here it says, even the Creator himself referred to the inclination of man as evil. And the Talmud says that the evil inclination each day is a creator force. It comes up with new ideas, new methods, new ways. And the Talmud says that each day the evil inclination it becomes very powerful on man and desires to kill him. As it says, it quotes a verse from Psalms 37, where it says, the evil man looks at the righteous man and desires to kill him. And here's where the Talmud says, and if God did not help him, he would not be able to succeed. What the Talmud means over here is that the evil inclination is something which is far deeper than meets the eye. But the evil inclination of man is extremely deep. As a matter of fact, the Talmud refers to the word, to the evil inclination as, one of the words for evil inclination is tzfuni, hidden, that which is hidden from sight. And the Talmud in Sukkah maintains that we don't even understand how deep it goes. In other words, it's the instinctual forces, we only see the surface of the instinctual force. but the instinctual force is far deeper than meets the eye. And the Talmud states that over here in Tractate of Kedushin, that if God didn't assist man every day, he would be destroyed by his evil inclination, because the instinctual forces are so powerful. Now, how does God assist man? There, I believe the answer is that God helps man by removing the perfection that the instinctual presents. In other words, when a person is caught up by an instinctual fantasy, so the reality of life will never live up to that fantasy. There are always defects in the desire. So if a person desires is overcome by a desire, let's say a desire to steal, for instance, he will see problems and things will come up which will not allow it to be so, done so simply. Or in any case, if it's a sexual desire, whatever it might be, there's always some kind of situation which takes away from the attractiveness of the fantasy, you see. And God always assists a person, and that's the way he assists them, by taking away, making it difficult for him, placing stumbling blocks, difficulties in his way. And what the Talmud is saying is, if God didn't do that, then man would never be able to overpower his evil inclination. In other words, if the evil inclination was perfect, was smooth, exactly the way he fantasized, if that's what he had in front of him, he would never make it. He'd never be able to prevent himself from falling prey. But since God created the world in a way that the evil inclination is never really in line with what the reality is, so that reduces the attractiveness of the evil. And God involves himself in people's lives, in righteous people's lives especially, and protects them by reducing the attractiveness of the evil. And that's why there we find the term God assisting him. It says if God did not assist man, man would never be able to overpower his evil inclination, because the instinctual force is far greater than meets the eye. And I believe that is what is meant in the verse where we say God assists, and also God is a salvation. A salvation is in face of danger, the external dangers. Assisting is insofar as the internal danger. The internal danger of man is that he give way to his evil inclination. And here God really assists man. And many times people ask, they say, well, where do you see God in your life? And they search for perhaps wealth or particular enjoyments.
We got 1 minute, Rabbi.
Okay. Or health or whatever. But people very seldom look in the right place. They very, very seldom look into their lives and think, look how God helped me. I could have done this horrible thing if God had not made it so difficult for me that I was able to see, and it made me stall, and in the stalling process I overcame the evil inclination. That's where a person really should search for God and should be thankful to God. So that's where God really assists an individual. Okay, I think we'll stop there.